Yeah, so I got the title, Should Christianity Be Made More Relevant? And I thought, well, the answer, a short answer is no. The longer answer is it doesn't need to be because it is relevant to today. The much longer answer is, of course, we need to do some work to see how we can help people to discover the relevance of the gospel to the issues of today. And that's what I'll do in this hour. So, for instance, if we wanted to say, let's take a core verse from chapter 14 of John's Gospel, where Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, that's foundational for us. And you might then think, well, but that's not what people are talking about. You know, if I spend a lot of time on my time on trains at the minute, and I always talk to people. Remembering that, of course, if you look at Jesus' ministry, so much of his ministry was on the way somewhere rather than the set piece things. And if I sat down next to someone and said, do you know, I would like to talk to you about how Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him. I think they would move because they think, what are you on about? But what I want to try and demonstrate, I hope, in this hour together, and I'll do it as interactively as possible, is that even that phrase is completely relevant to the issues of today. Now, what is it that people want to talk about on the train or at work or in all sorts of situations? Number of things. I think two things in particular that people like to talk about. One is politics, especially since Donald Trump came on the scene. They're always up for a conversation about that. And the second is media, what's going on the TV or what's going on in the films. And particularly, if you think then, just over the last couple of months, where you've had Trump's inauguration and what people have been talking about around Trump's inauguration. And then we've had the awards season and what's happened in the Oscars and the other awards. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do half the time looking, first of all, at that question of in relation to to kind of politics in terms of truth and the idea that we live in a post-truth world and we don't have truths, we have alternative facts. So we'll spend a little while looking at that, and then we'll spend a little while looking at the one film that that won the Oscars. No, it didn't. But does it matter? La La Land, and we'll spend a little while just looking at La La Land, and you'll see, I hope, in all of those, we'll see the relevance then of that passage from John 14, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So how do we get from one to the other on a train journey? So let's do, first of all, the question of truth. Now, in what we'll do with the first one is we'll do a bit of philosophy, that's okay, and in the second one we'll do a bit of film studies. And anyone here studied film studies? No, I can say what I like then, can't I? But anyway, I will do a little bit of film studies and we'll do a bit of philosophy. And I thought Pete Williams was going to be here so I could bounce any difficult questions. Yeah, any difficult philosophical questions off to him, but otherwise I'll have to handle it myself. Okay, I started off, Pete and I spent a long time travelling together and I felt I had a sort of a mentoring role with him, and then I discovered it turned around the other way and he was correcting my philosophy all the time, which was great. So if we look at truth, what we'll do is we will do, I think what I'll do is I'll do a little bit where I explain some theories of truth. What do we mean by truth? Okay, and then we'll do an exercise together. And I hope that what will come out of that exercise, we will explore a bit. It depends what comes out of it. But Aristotle's principle. Yeah?
Can people see what it is?
Can you see my writing? Good. Can you, Heather?
No.
You can come closer. I did have a shower. Yeah. Principle of non-contradiction. We'll do a little bit on Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction. I've run out of paper there. And what the distinction that some people draw between propositional truth and personal truth. Okay, so that's the bit of philosophy that we will learn today, I'm hoping. So theories of truth. It's sometimes talked about three different theories of truth or three different ways of understanding truth. It's not quite as simple as that. But the correspondence theory, the coherence theory, and pragmatic theory. So let me just explain those, and then we'll do a little exercise together. Okay, so correspondence theory of truth, which many people will say is not actually a theory of truth so much as the definition of truth. This is what truth is. So the correspondence theory of truth is, if I make a truth claim, a proposition, it is true if it corresponds with the real world. So if I say, this is a table, does that correspond with the real world? Is that actually a table? We are in England. Does that correspond with the real world? So a correspondence theory of truth says that something is true, a statement is true, if it corresponds with the real world. So therefore, a test about whether truth is, whether a statement is true, is by looking at the evidence for the correspondence with the world. So on the day of Trump's inauguration, how many people were actually there? Well, we look at the evidence. We look at the photos. And that's where we're told, oh, no, we know we've got a different number because they are alternative facts. So is it possible to have alternative facts? Because actually truth is what corresponds to the real world. Now, other people have placed an emphasis also on a second theory of truth. Is that one okay? Does that make sense? First of all, that's kind of like obvious, really. The second theory of truth is the coherence theory of truth that says if a statement is true, it will cohere together. It will make sense. Okay. Let me give you an example of some statements that don't make sense. If I say to you, I don't believe in astrology because I'm a Sagittarian, and Sagittarians don't believe in that kind of thing. Right? Okay. Or supposing I said to you, I cannot speak a word of English. Right? So it doesn't cohere together. There used to be a series of jokes that were incoherent jokes of, what's the difference between a duck? Answer, one leg is both the same, and as it walks along, its head bangs together. Nothing about it kind of makes sense. So you think there's something wrong then. We get this intuitive feeling that something is wrong. No, don't write it down. Tell it. It's a dad joke. Okay. This is where you have to be careful, right, with these two. Because although these can be good tests if a statement is not true, they are not sufficient for a statement to be true. Right? So a statement can cohere together, but not be true. So fairy stories, for instance, fairy stories on their own terms can cohere together, but they're not actually true. The story of Father Christmas can cohere together, make sense, but... Sorry. So the second test of truth is actually best done. So I would hold to the view that correspondence theory of truth is the definition of truth. Coherence is a good way of testing if something actually isn't really true, but it's not a full proof that something is true. Pragmatic theory of truth. Hello, welcome. Pragmatic theory of truth, developed particularly by William James, an American philosopher. You might not be surprised this grew up in America, is that if something is true, it will work. Again, we're in the same sort of area, I think, as the coherence theory of truth, that just because something works doesn't mean that it is true. But you would expect something that is true to work. So when my son was a little boy, I remember coming downstairs and finding him sat in a cardboard box. Well, hey, I'm in Christian ministry, we don't have very much. This is a normal part of life, find your son in a cardboard box. No, he said to me, I've made a car. And I said, yes, you've made a model of a car. And he said, no, I've made a car, Daddy. And I said, no, you made a symbolic representation of a car, haven't you? No, Daddy, I've made a car. And I'm trying to help him to see, he hadn't actually made a car. He had made a model, a symbolic representation. And I said to him, if it's a car, let's drive it round to the shops. You know, it won't actually work. It isn't actually true. He's been in therapy for the rest of his life, by the way, and is now head of philosophy in a boarding school, so that explains everything. But the point is that if something is true, you would expect it to work. But in the same way with the coherence theory of truth, just because it works doesn't make it true. So Peter will know, as a medic, there's a thing called placebos. I had an old friend who was a doctor years ago. She said to me how she was working in A&E, and they had a particular person coming in that was actually really nothing wrong with her, this old lady, but she complained of all these things every day and came in. And so one day they played a little bit of a trick on her. This is some while ago. It's probably not legal now. But they stood outside the curtained-off area where she was and said, "Oh, it's a very serious case, isn't it?" "Yes, it's a very serious case. I think she needs the ergonomics." "Not the ergonomics." "Yeah, they're such powerful drugs and they're so expensive, but they will work." And then they gave her some bright red vitamin tablets and she got better and never came back again. So it's called the placebo effect. Just because she believed it would work, it did. So just because something seems to work doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. There's your philosophy lesson for the day. Does that make sense? Okay. So now if we're on our train and we're having a conversation. No, I won't do it. I won't structure it like that, because what you're going to do now is not actually what you would say to them, but you're preparing yourself such that when you are on a train, you can talk to somebody. Okay. And so the statement that is made, has been made a lot in the media recently, is things. We live in a post-truth age. There is no truth, only alternative facts. Okay. Now, what I'd like you to do is to apply those three theories of truth, or if you like, those three tests of truth. Hello. Those three tests of truth to that statement. Does that make sense? Okay. So someone says, we live in a post-truth age, there is no truth, there are only alternative facts, right? Does that correspond with reality? Does that cohere together? Does it make sense? And does it work? Is it livable? Is that right? As an exercise. So turn into twos or threes. If you'd like to come and join in here, that would be great. Make sure everyone's included. And bounce around on those three, and then we'll take some feedback. Okay, shall we come back together and bounce some of these things around? I was thinking, actually, it might be easier with this one to start with the coherence theory of truth. So someone says... we live in a post-truth age. There is no truth, just alternative facts. Does that cohere together? Does that make sense?
No.
Why not?
We've got the force of gravity. It doesn't matter whether you agree with it or not. You know, if you drop things, they fall to the floor.
Okay, that's very good. That's more in the correspondence theory of truth. Because actually what you're saying is that statement doesn't correspond with the real world. But just taking it as, hold on to that. Right, as the Rogerian psychotherapist would say, hold that thought. But let's just take it just on its coherence one.
If the statement is saying there's no truth, how can that statement be true?
Yeah, it's denying itself, isn't it? Yeah, the statement of itself is actually denying itself. It's really just a restatement of the old view of what sometimes called relativism, of there is no absolute truth. You know, and someone said, there is no absolute truth. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. Are you certain? Yes. Are you absolutely certain? Yes, I'm absolutely certain. So you're saying it's absolutely true that there is no such thing as absolute truth. It actually contradicts itself in the statement. So making a statement that we live in a post-truth age, there is no truth, there are only alternative facts, doesn't actually cohere together. I would say to you, and same with that, what I've just said in terms of, you know, relativism, it's not a great way to build a relationship on a train journey, because actually it's a bit like kind of ridiculing as someone, isn't it? It's kind of like saying you're a bit stupid, really. So it's worth kind of knowing that, but it's not actually it's not a great kind of thing in it for building a relationship. So let's come back to the correspondence, as you were saying, in the world. So talk to us about gravity again, in the world.
In the world, as far as we can tell, every part of the Earth's surface has gravity. And if you drop something from a height, it falls towards the centre of the Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Other things in the world that are true, whether or not we believe them, there are no alternatives to it. That is just... I'll give you an example I often use, because we're then in the area of, whether people are talking about facts and truth or whether they're talking about opinions. Because people will kind of jump and say, oh, well, different people have different opinions, you know, which is true. People do have different opinions. That doesn't mean that something is actually true or not, just because different people have opinions. My wife thinks that I'm gorgeous and kissable. Right, that's her opinion. You don't think that, at least I hope not. But different people will have different opinions about things. I might like chocolate. You might not like chocolate. I don't like strawberries. You might like strawberries. Different. There are people who have different opinions. But just because people have different opinions doesn't mean that there are certain facts. You might, for instance, if you were a very sad man, you might have a view that Bath City is the best football club, right?
No, that is a fact.
So he has a view that Bath City is the best football club to support, right? That's an opinion. But if he then said, and last year Bath City won the FA Cup, right? That is not true. Right? Either they did win the FA Cup or they didn't win the FA Cup. It's a matter of fact rather than a matter of opinion. So we do, yes, live in a world in which people have different opinions and different views about things, but there is some objective reality. There is some truth out there. And that comes on to the third one there about the pragmatic theory of truth. Is it actually livable to say there is no truth, just alternative facts? Is that livable? Can we live like that? Why can we not live like that?
You have to have some
absolute truth.
You have to have some reliable
facts on which to base your action. Yeah. We have to. So I remember talking with I was doing a mission in a college, and the principal asked me in, and I thought, oh, flip, am I in trouble? But I wasn't at all. He said it was so good that we got everybody talking in the college, which was great. But he said, I'm delighted with the way in which you got everybody talking, but I have to tell you, I completely disagree with your view because I'm a relativist. I think that there is no absolute truth. And I said to him, God, that must make it really difficult when it comes to marking exam papers. How on earth do you do that? You know, because, you know, someone says, what's the capital of France? Well, capital of France, it's Paris, you know. But, oh, no, for me, it's Bognor Regis. You know, it's just an alternative fact, an alternative view. Life becomes unlivable in that particular way. So those are kind of things that I might want to talk away with people on. That actually, no, there has to be actually truth. There has to be an objective reality. So where does that come from? Where does truth come from? And that's where then I might be talking with them about the fact that if there is such a thing as truth, it must, and it's an objective truth, an objective reality, it must come outside of our subjective perspective and experience, and that points to the God behind the world who created the world. But then, what's the value of just some objective reality out there that we can't have anything, can't really know? Well, Jesus said, "I am the truth." Jesus said, "I am the truth." So he's saying that there is such a thing as truth, the truth. He says, I am the truth. But he says, I am the truth. Now, part of that, of course, is going back to the Old Testament of how God revealed himself to Moses, saying, I am. It's partly that claim to divinity. But it was also that kind of exposition of the personal nature of truth, that truth is not just impersonal, some impersonal objective reality, but there's a personal. And I might do a bit on Aristotle if you want to, but many will draw a distinction between propositional truth and personal truth. So propositional truth, some will say, is, well, that's a truth that you can make in a proposition, a statement out there. And other people say, oh, no, that's not really important because that doesn't impact you. What's important is personal truth, what I experience, my alternative facts, if you like, my personal experience. Well, as I understand it from what Jesus is saying, that actually those two go together. That there is a propositional truth. He makes it in a proposition. I am the truth. I am the way, the truth, the life. But I am. It's a personal, it's a relational opportunity for truth. So if I'd say to you, I love my wife, that's a proposition. I can make a statement. I love my wife. But that's no good to my wife unless actually it's personal, that I'm expressing it to her, I'm telling it to her, I'm showing it to her, I'm buying her flowers, and I can say that, and you think, what a lovely husband. If she was here, she'd say, when was that, Nick? Well, my father-in-law does it now. It's great. That truth is not just propositional, it is personal. So we find then in Jesus' statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life, a fulfillment, I think, to what we're looking for when we're talking about we live in a post-truth age with alternative facts. We know that can't be right. There is an objective reality. There is an objective truth. But actually, that is comes from God and is revealed in Jesus and enables us to have a personal relationship with him. Does that make sense? So I hope in that bit, what we're doing is we're saying, well, that part of that foundational verse that I started with in John chapter 14, we can see how it is relevant to the issues that are being talked about today. And I can assure you, you can talk to people about it on a train. I know. Is that okay? Is that helpful? Do you want me to do a bit on Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction, or do you want to move on to the next one about, and we'll talk about La La Land? Right, okay. Because, well, this is a thing that sometimes comes up in this, when people, particularly when talking about, people are talking about different opinions and different views, and they say, well, you know, I have one view, you have another view, and so on and so forth, like this. Now, foundational. And you, they'd say, well, you can believe this, and I believe something different, and that's okay. We all have separate beliefs. We have different beliefs. It's okay. Foundational to the principle of logic, there are three fundamental laws of logic: the principle of identity, the principle of non-contradiction, and the principle of the excluded middle. And the most important one of those, foundation of logic, is the Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction, which I will do for you in symbolic logic. Do you remember symbolic logic, Alan? Correct me if I'm wrong, because there are so many different terminologies that are used for this, so we'll see if this is the same as used. Okay, so you have a proposition, P, okay, I'm making a truth claim, a proposition, and that might be a true proposition. Is that the notation you've used? You can't remember. Okay, so that might be true. So you've got P, a proposition, which is true, okay? And then someone else says, no, the same proposition P, is not true. Ooh. Right? That proposition is not true. Okay? So here we've got a truth claim that proposition is true, and another one that proposition is not true. Okay? What Aristotle did is he says, is it possible for that proposition to be both true and not true at the same time? And Aristotle says, logically, not. So there's Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction in symbolic logic. How did you ever get through your life without knowing that? You're wondering. But what is important is this, right? Something, it's two different views. If they are contradictory, they cannot both be true, right? So if I, as a Christian, say that I believe that Jesus is God become man who died on a cross for us so that we can be forgiven, and my Muslim friend says, no, Jesus is a prophet, he's not actually God become man, he didn't actually die on the cross, those are contradictory views. They cannot both be true. By the fundamental principle of logic, which is Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction, one of the three foundations of logic. That doesn't mean, though, that whether this is where people get confused, that there's a difference between complementary and contradictory. And so two complementary views can both be true, but not two contradictory views. So if I, for instance, said, this is a table, statement P, this is a table, and someone else comes along and says, no, this is not a table, those two truth claims cannot both be true. It cannot, as Aristotle would say, it cannot both be a table and not a table at the same time. Does that make sense? But if someone comes along and says, you're saying it's a table, I'd say it's a piece of furniture. Or I'd say it's something made from wood and metal. Or I'd say it's something that the church owns. You see, that's other perspectives on it. They're complementary, they're not contradictory. So those can be true, whereas actually the statement, this is a table and this is not a table, are contradictory, and therefore they cannot both be true. So people might have all sorts of different beliefs about Jesus that may be complementary beliefs. But Jesus made the claim, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If that is true, it cannot also be not true at the same time as someone saying, there are other roads to God. There are other ways to receive, to come into God's presence. Does that make sense? Whatever people think about the Oscars and what happened. No. The point is, you will find I've had lots of conversations in trains about La La Land, right? How many of you have seen La La Land?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, let's do a little straw poll, right? Because I find La La Land is like Marmite. Okay, did you like it or not?
Yes.
You liked it?
Yes.
You didn't like it? No. You didn't like it? No. It's Marmite. People either love it or hate it. You see. Now, what happens is, I find that you can then have an unhelpful conversation with people about why they liked it or why they didn't like it, or I've had some heated conversations going on in trains around me. I think there's a deeper thing to it, actually. If you see it in the perspective of some simple film studies, which I'll show you. Right. Now, in film study, most films follow what's called the three-act story arc. Okay? The story is what's the story arc? Three acts, three parts to a film. The first part of the film is called exposition. Exposition is introducing the characters, introducing the setting, giving some backstory, enough backstory, so that you care about those characters, you're interested in those characters. The first part of the film, and by the way, the three acts will not always be the same length. You can get them, with a very short exposition, and then a much larger rising action, a small climax. They are in three acts. So exposition, we are introducing the characters, and then so that the emotion of the film is like this, and then there comes what is called an inciting incident, not an exciting incident, but although it usually is. And I can't spell incident. Right, an inciting incident. Something happens that sets up some kind of crisis. You've introduced the characters, and then there's some kind of crisis. And that, the second part of the second act of a film, is called rising action. Now, in rising action, what happens is these characters who've experienced this inciting incident are trying to resolve it, trying to deal with it, and the more they try to deal with it, the worse it gets. If we had time, we could analyse any number of different films, and you'll find they follow this same structure. They try to deal with it, it just gets worse and worse and worse, and then what you get, the third act, is called resolution. Resolution, where it's then all resolved, and everyone lives happily ever after, and with an emotional climax at the end. Okay. So that is a traditional story arc, three-act story arc. Now, how many acts are there in La La Land? They're signaled, actually, by slates that come up. Do you remember the first slate that came up and it said winter, and then it said, next one said spring, next one said summer, next one said fall, next one said winter. It actually had five acts to it, the film did. And whereas most films will have a resolution with an emotional climax, it didn't. There was no resolution. That bit at the end, what is that scene at the end? Even that last frame of the whole film where you see the two characters looking to each other in their eyes. What's in their eyes? What's going on in their eyes? Right? There is no resolution in the film. And that is why so many people have found it unfulfilling, unsatisfying, because it doesn't follow the normal, typical story arc. However, life is not like that. Life isn't like that. We don't have these complete resolutions. Our life goes on. And with films, if you take a film, take, for instance, Pretty Woman, right? Pretty Woman, Richard Gere, Julia Roberts. He takes her off the street as a prostitute. There's all the how will she be treated. We're introduced to them at the beginning. How will she be treated? And she has that scene where she goes in and buys all those clothes and so on and so forth. And then it's resolved with the emotional climax that he drives off with her in his sports car. That's the end of it, right? Supposing Pretty Woman had two more acts, what would you have? Probably relationship breakdown, recrimination, because that's the reality of it, right? So we're used to a three-act story arc where everything is resolved. Why some people don't like, and you find this, most people who didn't like it, they will say, it just was unresolved. It wasn't fulfilled, right? Now, then there's a question that you have to ask yourself. Why is it that we like resolutions? And it's kind of like a chicken and egg kind of question. Is it that we like resolutions at the end of our films and our stories because we're so used to them? Or is it that actually filmmakers normally make films like this, and indeed books and plays and other stories will have the same three-act story arc? Is it we make those because somehow deep in our hearts is a desire for resolution? And I think it's that actually, you know, Scripture says, 1 Peter, oh, for goodness sake, edit this bit out of the tape, will you? Let me just look it up. I tell you, I did Navigators when I was a student, and I learned so much Scripture, and then what's happened is I'm getting older, I just forget it. It's frightening. Anyway, okay, so 1 Peter, 1 Peter 1, verse 20. So if you restart the tape, 1 Peter 1, verse 20, as we all remember, says, he was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last days for your sake. So that actually Jesus was chosen before the creation of the world. Even before the foundation of the world, God's plan of salvation was in place. And is it then that what's happened is God has put within our hearts an understanding of his plan of salvation, which is why, if you look in ancient mythology and stories through the ages, there's so much of the gospel in those ancient mythological stories and other stories. And is it then that actually we have within us a yearning for resolution, for final judgment, for actually the rights being, wrongs being righted and things being resolved and a happy ever after answer? Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus claims that there is a way to God through him, that we can be forgiven and we can be restored, and that there will be a final judgment and a final answer and a final restoration. That's the kind of way in which I would say that Bible passage is just as relevant today in award season, in conversations around La La Land. And I've taken much less than my hour. I can't believe it.
Well, let's wind it up. I mean, they're great, you know, to be talking about truth and reason and argument, the nature of it. The whole series has been that faith is reasonable, that A is not non-A. There are some things that are true, and we have to distinguish between what is true and what is not true, and make sure that our proclamation of the faith is about truth statements, and that we can substantiate them. Not finally, not with ultimate knowledge, but we can give a reason for the hope that's within us. Mm-hmm. We can point to the evidence, and well, that's one way or another what we've been trying to do throughout this sort of series of sessions, exploring the implications of truth and truth discussions. And I'm hoping that you will come over the time we'll be doing this course, is that it helps feed into your conversations and comments that you've made along the way that have sharpened and put some edge to it. So, Nick, thank you very much for finishing up on that positive note.